You might think that, like, we're just all over the place in terms of the women we pick, but we're really not. The first semester, remember, we did a whole bunch of barren women. Then we did a whole bunch, then we did the Shalshelet to David HaMelech. And now what we've been doing, although we did Dvorah because it was the Haftorah, and then we did the Nashim Tzidkaniyot because that was the Parsha, we did Avigail. The next logical thing is to finish with the Nevi'ot, where today we'll do Huldah, and then of course we'll come to Esther before Purim. Now, I think the Nevi'ah that is least known about is Huldah. Now, of course, I tell a funny story about a friend of mine who gave a shir on Huldah, and she says, well, nobody names their child Huldah, and then she put the shir up online, and then her phone starts ringing. Hello, this is Huldah. Hello, this is Huldah. So apparently people do give the name Huldah, but it is not as common as the other ones, and we'll try to determine why. So the first thing we want to find out what's special about her, what's unique about her, what is her nevuah, and this appears at the end. And this appears at the end of Sefer Melachim Bet. Now understand, when we're talking about the end of Melachim Bet, we're really talking about the end of Bayit Rishon, okay? And thank you so much. And we're talking specifically probably about 5th, 6th century BCE. Now let me just give you a little bit of background before we go into this perek. Remember, we had King Ahaz. Ahaz was good or bad?
Good.
No, Ahaz was a very bad king. Okay, Ahaz was a really, really bad. You had a 50-50 chance there. Okay, Ahaz was a really, really bad king. He burned the Torah. He puts up idols in the Mikdash, the whole bit. But he is the father of Chizkiyahu. Okay, Chizkiyahu though was a very, very good king. After Chizkiyahu, then we have Chizkiyahu's son Menashe, and from there it's downhill.
He was bad.
Menashe was a very bad king. Then we have Amon, who was a corrupt king. He's even assassinated by his own servants. The people kill his servants. Then we have the king after that is, we have Yoshio.
He was good.
Correct. Yoshio becomes king at age 8. He grew up, remember, though, with an evil father. Okay? And so, where does he get his idea from? We'll see that here in the Psukim. So let's first go into the Perek. Let's see what's going on here, and then we will be able to analyze the story. Ben Shmoneh Shana Yoshiyahu Bimalcho, V'shloshim V'achat Shana Malach B'Yerushalayim, V'shem Imo Yedida Bat Adaya Mibatzkat. Okay, so that's the first thing. We know that he became king when he was 8. Now, you all know that for an 8-year-old to rule, he's obviously not making the decisions on his own. He rules for 31 years. Because he became a king so young, that's what allows him to rule that long. Vayaz hayashar b'enei Hashem, vayelech b'chol derech David aviv, v'lo sarya min usmo. So the pasuk tells us very clearly that he is doing good in the eyes of God, as did David HaMelech. Vayihi b'shmona esrei shana lemelech Yoshiyahu shalach HaMelech el Shafan hu ben Meshulam hasofer beit Hashem lemor. Alei el Chilkiyahu haKohen haGadol vayitem et haKesef haMuva beit Hashem asher asfu shomei hasaf me'et Hashem. In his 18th year of his reign, meaning that he is 26 years old, he sends messengers to the Beit HaMikdash that they should take the money that they have collected and they should use it to what we call Bekabayit. He needs to do Shiputzim. Okay, and that is what they should do with this money. Vayitnuhu al yidei osei melacha, the money should be given to the craftsmen hamefukadim beit Hashem v'yitnu oto laosei melacha asher beit Hashem lechazek bedek habayit, and this money should be given over in order to fix up the Beit HaMikdash. לחרשים ולבונים ולגודורים ולקנות העצים ואבני מחצב לחזק את הבית. All the supplies that you need in order to fix the בית המקדש. אך לא יחשב איתם הכסף. He says, we're not even going to, we're going to use the honor system, we're not going to demand an accounting because that would stop them from doing their work. Under normal situations, we would always ask for an accounting, okay, especially when we're talking about public money, public tzedakah money. You should never, you're never supposed to give charity to a place that doesn't have clear, what do we call that today? In English we call it transparency, right? Everything, you know where the money's going. Okay, but here he's making an unusual situation. They're working on this honor, on this honor system. ויומך חלקיהו כהן הגדול על שפן הסופר ספר התורה מצאתי בבית השם ויתן חלקיה את הספר על שפן ויקראהו. While they're doing the שיפוצים in the בית המקדש, they find a safer Torah. Now, why is this surprising? Given, he gives it to Shafan, and Shafan reads it. And what happens? Let me read the psukim, and then we'll go back and answer these questions. Vayavo Shafan hasofer el hamelech. So Shafan comes to the king. Vayeshev et hamelech davar. Vayomer. Did I just skip a line? Vayeshev el hamelech davar. Vayomer hatichi avadecha et hakesach simza beit Hashem. Vayitnuhu al yedeir shamlacham efukudim beit Hashem. He says, you know, you gave me the money, and we were doing this fixing up. We were doing the shiputzim. Vayaget Shafan hamelech hasofer el hamelech. ויגד שפן הסופר למלך לאמור ספר נתן לי חלקי הכהן ויקראהו שפן לפני המלך. He says, by the way, while we were doing the shiputzim, Chilkiah the Kohen gave me this sefer Torah that he found. ויהי כשמו המלך את ספר דברי ספר תורה ויקרא את בגדיו. The king's reaction to reading the Torah is he rips his clothing. Rips his clothing is obviously a sign of mourning. So again, so the next question is, so why is it surprising that they found the Sefer Torah? The next question that we have to ask is, why is it mourning? Right, why is this sad? Vayitzav ha-melech et Chilkiah ha-kohen ve-et achikam ben Shafan ve-et achbor ben Michaya ve-et Shafan ha-sofer ve-et asaya eved ha-melech le-mor. The king then takes some of his most loyal servants and he says to them in verse 13, Lechu dirshu et Hashem ba'adi. Go seek out God for me, uba'ad ha'am, and for the nation, uba'ad kol Yehuda, and for all of Yehuda, al divrei ha-sefer ha-nimtza hazeh, in order to explain what the purpose is of this Torah that we found, ki gidulat chamat Hashem, asher hi nitzta banu, because obviously God is angry at us, ala sheloshem anu avotenu al divrei ha-sefer hazeh, because our forefathers did not keep the Torah the way it should have been, lasot kechol ha-katuv eleinu. So what did they do? Vayele Chilkiah Kohen, Vachikam, Vaachbar, Vishafan, Vaasaya, El Chulda Hanivia, Eshet Shalom Ben Tikva, Ben Charchas, Shomer Habigadim. So he says to them, go seek out God, and their reaction is to go to Chulda Hanivia. And we find out a little bit about who she's married to and what he does. We'll come back to that. Vihi Yoshevet Birushalayim, Bimishneh. And she's sitting in Yerushalayim in a place called the Mishneh. Vayedabru Eleha. And they tell her over what has happened. Vatomer Elehem. And here is her nevuah. Ko amar Hashem Elohei Yisrael. Imru le'ish asher shalach etchem elai. This is the message that you should give to the man who has sent you. Notice she does not address him by name. Ko amar Hashem. Hineni mevi ra'ah el hamakom hazeh. Va'al Yoshvav. Here is, I'm going to bring destruction onto this place and to all of its inhabitants. Et kol divrei ha-sefer shekara melech Yehuda, as it says in the Torah which was read by the king. Tachat asher azavuni Vayaktu lelohim acherim. Because you left me and brought karbanot to the other gods, leman hachiseni b'chol ma'aseh yedehem, in order to make me angry with everything that they did, v'nitztach hamoti b'makom hazeh, and my anger has been ignited against them, v'lo tichabeh, and it will not be put out. Vel melech Yehuda ha-sholechetchem l'shirot ha-shashem. But the king who sent you here to find out about God, ko tomu elav. This is a special message for him. Ko amar Hashem Elohei Yisrael hadavrim asher shamata. Here's the message that is going to go to you. Ya'an rach levavecha, because your heart is soft. Vatichna mipnei Hashem, and you gave in to Hashem, b'shem acha asher dibarti el makom hazeh, and you listened to the message that I have given, ve'el yoshvav liyot l'shama u'leklala, vatikra ebegadecha, because of the way you reacted, and because of what you heard about the destruction, and because of the tearing of your clothing, vatifke lefanai, and you cry before me, gam anochi shamati num Hashem, I hear and I see your reaction, l'chein, hinini osifcha el avotecha v'ne'esafte el kivrotecha b'shalom v'lo tir'ena einecha b'chol hara'a ashin mevi el makom hazeh. Okay? You are not going to witness any of the destruction. The destruction is going to happen, but you are not going to see it because of the way you reacted. Vayashivu el hamelech davar, and they bring this message back to the king. So now we have a whole, besides we have to figure out what this whole story is with the Sefer Torah. What's unusual about it? Why does it cause him to react? Now, at the same time period, who is the Navi at the time period of the destruction of the temple? Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu is alive and well at this point in time, and he is giving prophecy. So that becomes another question. If he tells them to go lidrosh et Hashem, why do they seek out Hulda rather than going to Yirmiyahu? Who is she? And finally, I think the most important question is, we know that we have a list of 48 men and 7 women who were Nevi'im Nevi'ot. But the Gemara there says that actually there were many, many, many more people who had prophecy. But we don't have those prophecies written down because those prophecies were not necessary for the future. The only prophecies that became saved were prophecies shehutz rechu ledorot that were necessary for the future generations. So what is it about her, this particular nevuah? This is all we have about her. Mm-hmm. This is it. This is her nevuah. What is it about this nevuah that makes it necessary for the future? Okay, so let's start with this Sefer Torah. Okay, what is this Torah that was found? Now, if you look at source number two is the Rashi here in our Perek. And the first thing Rashi tells us is that this Torah had been hidden beneath a pile of stones buried there when Ahaz burned the Torah. Remember we said Ahaz was the king 3 kings ago, okay? But he had gone on this mass destruction of anything that had holiness to it. And apparently one of the Kohanim must have taken the Sefer Torah and hidden it somewhere in the Mikdash. And now when they're doing Shiputzim, all of a sudden they find this Torah. So why would that be a source of mourning? Wouldn't it be a source of joy? Either that there aren't more. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, but let's just get to the pshat here in the pasuk. It reminds you of what has been done, that it's been lying there, you know, forgotten under a pile of rocks for all these years. It is a very tragic idea. And the question is, and then there's some freshmen who want to say, well, they didn't even have any Torah scrolls, that Ahaz had actually destroyed them all. But that's difficult for us to accept because, during Chizkiyahu's time, they didn't have a Torah. So it seems to be more than that. It seems to be that according to Rav Yosef Albo says that there was something unique about this Torah. This was the Torah that was handwritten by Moshe Rabbeinu. And you have it here in the Mitzudot as well in source number 3. The Kohanim feared that Ahaz would send forth against the Torah this specific scroll, which was written by Moshe from God, that they had been located beside the Aron. You know, that in the Aron, there was also the Tzinzenet Haman, there was the Mateh of Aharon, and there was over the Sefer Torah that was written by Moshe. So the Kohanim were afraid that Ahaz was going to specifically go after that Torah. So they took it, buried it, and after his death, they searched for it, and they could not find it. They died. He wasn't around. Where was it? Okay? And you know how things get right? And they couldn't find it then, and now they are finding it now. Okay, so that would explain why specifically it was hidden, and that would explain specifically why they are sad about it. Now, if you look at if you continue looking here at our story, we will actually understand that according to the Sfarno, in Sefer Dvarim, yes, the source number Sfarno in Sefer Dvarim explains, it seems that the book found by Chilkiah was the scroll that Moshe gave to the priests who carried it with the Ark of the Covenant mentioned above in Dvarim, containing only the portion of the king. In that scroll, Yoshua recorded the covenant that he made with the nation in Shechem, that they would commit themselves to serve Hashem in true devotion, in ideas and actions. When Yoshiyahu read this and realized how much they had diverged from this covenant, he was fearful and sought out God. So now we're taking it a step further. It's not only the actual finding of the scroll itself, but it seems to be that this was not an entire Chamishei Chumshei Torah. According to Sfarno, it was just Dvarim, apparently, and specifically, it was opened to the covenant, the Brit, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had made with Am Yisrael, and when Yoshiyahu remembers how far they are away from the Brit, that's what makes him seek out and go look for an explanation. Now, one second. There is another opinion, and that other opinion is that the pasuk was the Torah was actually opened to source number 13. Source number 13 is also in Devarim. Now, for the most part, by the way, when a Torah is standing in the ark, unused, you have 15 Torahs in your shul, where is it rolled to? No, you don't have. Nobody takes out. If you think somebody takes out all the Torahs every week and rolls them, that's not reasonable. The one that they're going to read, or two that they're going to read, nobody takes out all 15 and rolls them every week. That doesn't happen. Anybody know? All Torah scrolls are kept at Bereishit. That's where they are kept at. So if you find a random Torah hidden in the floor, it should be technically on Bereishit. When they open it, it's not on Bereishit, but what pasuk is it at? Yolich Hashem otcha ve'et malachecha. God will lead you and your king. Asher takim elecha, that you have established over you, el goy asher lo yadata. He's going to send you into exile to a nation that you never knew from. Ata va'otecha va'vadita sham Elohim acherim eitz ve'even. And when you get to exile, you're going to worship idols. So instead of being at Bereishit, all of a sudden he opens it, and there's this verse saying, you king are going into exile. Now we understand why that would cause Yoshiyahu grief, hence the ripping of the clothing, and it would also cause him to seek out the Navi and say, what is the Pesha? What does this mean? What is the message that is coming to me from this verse?
My question was, in 11, the Sfarno seems to say that Joshua had written and added to the Torah of Moshe, which is fine with me.
Right.
But I'm just curious as to, am I reading the English correctly?
There is, listen, the end of Torah describes the death of Moshe. Who wrote that? Okay. So it's not such a problem. But in ideas here, we see that we understand the background and what is causing Yoshiyahu to panic. So now let's go to our next question. Why does he specifically go to Huldah when he had the ability to go to Yirmiyahu? So that we actually have here in the Gemara that you have in source number 6. Source number 6 is the, well actually let's go back to 5 and then we'll come down to 6. Source number 5 is the Midrash in Psikta Rabbah, which tells us, Yirmiyahu prophesied in the markets, Sophania in the synagogues, and Huldah with the women. So first of all, we're finding out that not only was Yirmiyahu around, but also Sophania, which tells you by the fact, and we know that the people at this point are, you know, approaching destruction of the temple, so we see that God is sending them multiple Nevi'im in order to try to change the situation. Now, what does that mean to you when it says that Yirmiyahu's in the markets, Sophania's in the synagogues, and Huldah's with the women? How do you understand that sentence?
Divide and conquer.
Correct. I don't even so much as divide and conquer as much as this also, you know, everybody's a specialist. Okay, so right, when we talk about what's the difference between the markets and the synagogues?
The learned and non-learned.
Correct. The learned and the non-learned, the guys in the synagogues is Yirmiyahu's specialty. Sophania seems to be talking to the average guy in the street, and it seems to be that Huldah was the one who was speaking to the women. Different people need different messages, and therefore there are different people to bring these messages. So that is one possibility, and we saw this last week when we talked about Miriam, that her goal was also to bring to the women. We saw that with Sarah, that she converted the women. So it's not so unreasonable to us to say that that was Huldah's job as well. But if Huldah is the prophetess for the women, why is the king sending to her now? So now let's go into the Gemara in source number 6. The Talmud in Megillah 14b says, regarding Huldah, it says, Chilkiyahu went to Huldah Nevi'ah. The question, how could she prophesy in Yirmiyahu's region? Like it's as if, you know, like it's his, stepping on his turf, right? How could Yoshiyahu abandon Yirmiyahu and send for her? Which I think makes this question even stronger. So the first answer is fascinating. The first answer Rav gives is she was his relative, and he did not mind.
Okay.
Now, what does that mean?
Should be she did not mind.
that there's certain things like within, you know, so it's all in the family. Now, what does that mean, by the way, that Yirmiyahu and Huldah were relatives?
Related.
What does that mean that they were related? So we're going to come down to that in a few minutes. Let's just continue with the Gemara, and you'll see the answer. Yes, she and Yirmiyahu are cousins. Not that Yoshiyahu, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. She and Yirmiyahu, so that's why Yirmiyahu doesn't care. She was his relative, his meaning Yirmiyahu's, and I'm going to show you why that's important in a minute. Question, why did Yoshiyahu abandon Yirmiyahu and ask for her? Answer number one was, this is because women are more merciful. Women are Rachmaniot. Now, you know that Nevuah is
from Hashem.
From Hashem. So what difference does it make who's delivering the message?
Oh, but it does, because they're going to choose words that are a little bit more comforting, maybe.
Right.
So
and you know as well as I do, you can even say the same sentence, but with a different tone of voice. You can say, close the door, or you can say, close the door! You know, you've said the exact same thing, but as soon as you change the tone, you're already changing the tone of the message. So although the Navi does not have the ability to change the message, the Navi does have the ability to use a certain tone. So here, they specifically choosing to go to Huldah because she is a Nevi'ah. Now let me just point out to you, and we should have picked up on this earlier, before Yitziat Mitzrayim, and we spoke about this last week, we have two men and a woman leading Bnei Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael. At this point in time, we're talking about Bnei Yisrael about to leave, and again we have two men and a woman. So that too is significant as well. So they're going to Huldah because women are more merciful. Answer number two is a fascinating answer. Answer number two is Rabbi Yochanan, who says Yirmiyahu was not there. He wasn't there, he just wasn't available. Where was he? He had gone to return the 10 tribes. Where were the 10 tribes? The 10 tribes have already been taken into exile by the Assyrians. Okay, and according, because remember we have this whole thing, are the 10 tribes going to come back? And we have the Nebuah and Yechezkel to talk about the reunification of the 10 tribes. So that one of the opinions here, this is a very important Gemara, it seems that Yirmiyahu at this point in time went and brought back some of those Shvatim, so that some of those Shvatim were present in the Galut of the two tribes and are still available today. And that brings the question, how do we know that they returned? And he brings some proof for that. But let's skip, because we're not talking about the 10 tribes today, let's skip down to Rabbi Nachman.
I remember reading somewhere else that he also wasn't as accepted within the Am yet.
Well, we know that they tried to kill, we know they tried to kill Yirmiyahu, remember? They tried to, you know, he wasn't exactly a popular figure. But skip down to where it says Rabbi Nachman. It says question, answer, Rabbi Nachman. Huldah descended from Yehoshua. It says regarding her husband Ben Cherchas, and it says about Yehoshua Bisimnas Cheres. Question: 8 Nevi'im Kohanim descended from Rachav the harlot, Rachav HaZonah, which we're going to talk about in 2 or 3 weeks, so you remember this. And these are the names of the 8 Nevi'im that descended from Rachav. Rav Yehuda says also Huldah was from Rachav, as it says about her Ben Tikva, like it says regarding Rachav, Tikvat Chut Hashani. If so, she was not from Yehoshua. So the answer is, together we will conclude the teaching, Rachav converted, Yehoshua married her, and that's the end of our Gemara.
No, question.
A question. But it's a known fact that Yehoshua did not have children. As it says, Nun beno Yehoshua beno, but no further. Their answer is, he has sons, but he has no... He had no sons, but he had daughters. Okay, so this Gemara tells us some fascinating facts about a whole bunch of different people. First of all, what it tells us here is that both Yirmiyahu and Huldah are cousins. In what way? They're descendants from Yehoshua and Rachav. And Rachav, I say, we'll talk about this in a few weeks, converts, marries Yehoshua. They have no sons, but they do have daughters, and these daughters consent, and not only are these two Nevi'im descendants from them, but eventually 8 different Nevi'im. Now, when does Rachav appear in our story? Just when Nisa La'aretz, when they're entering the land, they're just about to go in, and her descendants are the one who are prophesizing when they are going out. Now, let's go back to what we know about Huldah from the Pasuk, because it comes, Gemara here mentioned it as an important piece. Okay, so we know about her in Pasuk Yud Dalet, right? They go to her as Huldah HaNevi'ah. Now, we spoke about this when we saw Devorah, we spoke about it in terms of Miriam, and we're going to speak about it now for just 2 minutes. As soon as it's you see the word Nevi'ah, what does that tell you about her? What does that mean? What do you know about her automatically, by definition? When somebody is a Nevi'ah, or a Navi, what do you know about them according to Rambam? You know that they have... Okay, so first of all, you know they have a direct connection with God. But where do they get that direct connection from? It means that they have developed their personality to a point of spiritual perfection. They have reached, the Rambam describes it as somebody, you have to be highly intelligent. You have to be a broad and sedate mind. You have to know a lot of things about a lot of things. You have to be controlling your negative character traits. You also have to be rich. That's a side thing, okay? There are a whole bunch of things that go along with what it means when she's in the V'a, so we have to just stop for a minute and talk about that. God just doesn't pick any random people to be a Navi. It's something you have to really develop yourself, and that was the whole concept of the B'nei HaNaviim. You could go to Navi school, and you develop your personality, and then you have this direct relationship with God. I don't know whether it was separate classes. That I don't know.
I didn't answer.
I know. It doesn't. We don't have reference to a school for women. But there were women. So right. Okay. Then she's described as Eshet Shalom Ben Tikva. Okay. And what is Ben Harchas? Now he's called the Shomer Bigadim. What kind of job is that? What? You are in Pasuk Yud Dalet. What is the job of Shomer Begadim? It could be the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. It means the keeper of the garments. So it either could be the keeper of the Kohen Gadol garments, or it could be the royal garment of the king. We are not clear of what you know, whose clothing he was. I guess we call that today a personal shopper, perhaps. Okay, but that seems to be his job. Which indicates also that, by the way, that makes her and her husband part of the royal inner circle. Right. Okay, they are now. Let's look at his name. Right. Right. Right, correct. But we'll talk about that in a second. Hold on a minute. Let's just look at his name for a minute. Who is her husband? What is his name? Shalom ben Tikva. Now, what does the word Shalom mean?
Shalom.
It could be from Shalom, which would be peace, or it could be from Shalem, meaning whole. Okay? So right away that indicates to you that we're talking about an unusual person, somebody whose name reflects a certain amount of completion. Now, the Medrash tells us a fascinating story about our Shulam. Let's look at it in source number 12. Source number 12 is the Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer. He says like this: Rebbe Azaria Omer, Teidalacha Koa Chastaka. I'm going to tell you the strength, the power of giving charity. Where do we learn it from? Re'eim in Shalom ben Tikva. We learn it from Huldah's husband. Shahaya migidolei hador. So that's another thing we learn about him, that she was married appropriately to one of the leaders of the generation. V'haya oset tzedakot b'chol yom v'yom. This guy Shulam was involved in daily good deeds. What was his deeds? Ma haya oseh? Haya mimalei et hechamat mayim v'yoshev al petach ha'ir. He would fill up the canteens of water and he would leave it by the gates of the city. V'chol mi shahaya ba min haderech, whoever was coming from the road, haya mashkeh, he would give them to drink. Umeshiv et nafsho alav. And you know as well as I do that giving somebody drink, you can really literally save their lives. And you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, you know, the people who bring food to the Kotel after the fasts. Have you ever seen that? Right. So this is the same kind of thing. He says he had some sort of water stand that he set up at the gates of Yerushalayim, and anybody who was coming in, he would give them to drink. Umeshiv et nafsho alav. That's an important bitoy. And like, return his soul to him. Now listen to this next sentence. Ubizchut hatzdaka she'asa, because of the charity that he did, sharta ruach hakodesh al ishto. Yeah. Because of the good deeds that he does, his wife is rewarded. How do you understand that?
The other way around.
You used to think it the other way around. What is this? What does this tell you?
That they had an interaction.
Correct. That's exactly, I think, what the Medrash is telling us, that there is, that, you know, one in one is not two. In their marriage, one and one is one, and he already is the Gadol Hador, so God doesn't reward him, but rewarding his wife is equivalent to rewarding him, and that is why she gets the Ruach HaKodesh.
It could also be that because of his goodness and his doing this, that their home was imbued with all of the positive attributes that she needed to be able to concentrate on her Nevuah.
And that's what allows her. Her relationship with him is what allows her to reach this stage. And that explains why his name here is mentioned. Limafreya hayashmo ben Sachra. Kishem shata omer kitov Sachra misar kesef. Now, u kishamet ba'ala, chasruts dakot ba'ala, veitzu kol Yisrael legbo chesed im shalom ben tikva. When he died, you can imagine, there came out this huge funeral to honor him. Now listen what happens. U'u et hagidud sheba alehem. All of a sudden, they're coming out to bury him, and all of a sudden, they see an enemy army coming towards them. Hishlichu et ha'ish bekever Elisha. And they don't have a chance to give him the proper burial because they see the enemy coming. So they just basically throw him into what was known as Kever Elisha. Halacha ish v'nagab atzmot Elisha v'chaya. His bones touch Elisha's bones. Now, you know, we studied here already a story of Elisha. One of the main things Elisha does is Elisha revives dead. So even when Elisha is dead, he's successful in reviving the dead. V'acharkach holid Chanmael ben Shalu. Now let's see what these stories are. Now first of all, I didn't bring it. Get to that in a minute. So first of all, the story of the throwing the body into the grave is one that appears actually in Melachim. In Melachim, we have that story, but there we're not given a name, we're not given any personality. But you see, if you had to pick one word that describes Shalom here, what word would you choose? You'd probably choose the word revival. He revives the travelers by giving them water, and then of course his body is revived when they touch Yoshiyahu and you can Elisha, and you can look at this up, and it's in Melachim Bet Perek Yud Gimel. It's in Melachim Bet Perek Yud Gimel. They were burying the man, they saw the troops coming, they throw the body into Elisha's grave, the body rolled over, touched the bones of Elisha, and the man comes back into life. Now, here's the fascinating thing. It tells us it's not just he comes back to life, but he, after we're talking about revival, they have a son. Now, who is the son that they have? They have this son named Chanamel. Now, Chanamel we meet again, actually, in the Sefer of Yirmiyahu, which you have in Source 14. In Source 14, Hashem tells Yirmiyahu that Hine Chanamel ben Shalom dodecha. Remember we said that? They're cousins. So here you see it again. Hashem tells him that Chanamel ben Shalom, your cousin, is going to come to you and he's going to say, Kinei lecha et sadi asher ba'anatot. Buy my field, which is an anatot, ki lecha mishpat ha'geula liknot. Because you are the closest relative and I want, you know, you're supposed to keep the land and the family. Now, at what point in Jewish history is he telling Yirmiyahu to buy the field? Half the land has already gone to exile. The Babylonians are already standing at the door. Who wants to buy land in Eretz Israel when the Babylonians are taking you into exile? Ko'amar Hashem Tzvaot, and Hashem tells him, write down this transaction of the land sale, and the part that's signed on it. Put this scroll into Kadim, which is something we know about. So that it should last a long time. Hashem tells Yirmiyahu, and that's the whole purpose of buying the field, that there's going to be a time again. I know it's exile, But the time is going to come when we're going to come back to the land and we're going to rebuild our houses and we're going to replant our vineyards. So even here too, the son of Hanmael becomes the vehicle of the prophecy of Yirmiyahu, which again talks about revival. Okay? And so that becomes the theme that throws who here. And you'll notice, by the way, that Shalom's name, what's his father's name? Shalom ben Tikva. What's Tikva? Tikva is nothing more than hope. Now, what is hope? Hope is exactly that. The situation seems to be hopeless. You are dead. You know, that is the situation, and all of a sudden, he is revival. You are going into exile, and all of a sudden, the message is by the field because there will be a revival. Correct. And even his name, correct, also has that idea of the favor, the chen of God's eyes. So that this child, this Hanmael, is also who he himself is, a living miracle, plays a role in this giving hope to the people. So now that would explain to us again, not only are they going to her because she's a woman, they're also going to her because they're hoping that they're going to get a message of revival and rejuvenation. Now, what is the prophecy that she gives? She gives this, and let's go to one more message. Why else would they go to her? Another reason they go to her is, think about Yitziat Mitzrayim. There was this idea of Bizchut Nashim, Tzidkaniyot. So here we're going to say, well, maybe if we go to Isha Tzadika, again, she will be able to do something for them in her role of Nevi'ah. Maybe she will be able to pray for them. But the Nevu'ah that she gives them in Pasuk Tedvav is essentially that the destruction is coming. The people and everything are going to be destroyed. And that is because of the Avodah Zarah that was did. Now it's odd, and I think strange, that she doesn't call the king by his name. Right? Do you notice that? The whole time she refers to him as the man who sent you. Why doesn't she refer to him as... Yeah, I think that would be a very possible reason that it's not personal. That's right. This is not happening because of him. Okay, you know, he himself, we know, is a very good king, and therefore she doesn't want to associate it with his name. Now, what differentiates Huldah from the other Yirmiyahu, for instance, at this point in time, is the tone of mercy that she has in her message. And she basically tells Yoshiyahu that although the destruction is going to come, he is not going to be the one who witnesses the destruction. Why? Because he humbled himself before God, because he accepted the prophecy. Apparently then, she turns, Yoshiyahu gets this message, and you could actually react to it in two ways. One way you could say, well, destruction is coming, so what difference does it make? Or you could say, look, the destruction is going to come, but there are certain things we can do, perhaps, to mitigate it, to make it work. Okay, so let's look here, first of all, there's no number on it, I apologize, in the Divrei HaYamim, which should be source number 15. Vayas Yoshiyahu b'Yishalayim Pesach laHashem, vayishchatu haPesach ba'arbas haChodesh haRishon. One of the things that he does after he sees this prophecy is he makes this huge Pesach ceremony. Vayamer haKohanim al mishmarotam v'yichaskem l'avodat Beit Hashem, and he encourages the Kohanim to do this ceremony as it is. Vayomal haLevi'im haMevinim l'chol Yisrael haKdoshim laHashem tenu et Aron haKodesh b'Bayit asher bana Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael. Ein lechem maseh b'katefata ivdu at Hashem Eloheihem Et Amo Yisrael. And he tells the Levi'im to leave the Aron in the Mikdash. Now look at the Radak. Radak tells us, Ulai Hotziu Min Hashem Misham Kasher Sam HaPesel B'Veit Elohim. His first personality is he gives a possible explanation. Maybe when Menashe had to make room for his idol, he took out the Aron, so now Yoshiyahu's putting it back. Aval yesh litmora, hayech lo chziru shamachar. Like, he says, but that's not a good reason, because how come they wouldn't have put it back before that? Hechnu v'shav b'tshuva v'esir ha-semel b'beit Hashem. Ki even, also Menashe himself went through a period of tshuva, and that should have been the first thing he did. So Radak explains, v'chazal pershu, shetziva lignoz et ha'aron, kidei shalo yigale im ha-gola. What does Yoshiyahu do? Yoshiyahu takes the Aron and he hides it. Why does he hide it? Because he knows they're going into exile. And although we see the menorah, right, going to exile, the Aron...
We're still looking
for the menorah, but this idea of the Aron doesn't get taken into exile. The Aron is not in the Vatican. Okay, and we know that because here he hid the Aron. The Amu, Evan Haita Bebeit Kodshei HaKodeshim B'Ma'aravo. In the Kodei Kodeshim there was this rock. The Aleha Yaha Aron Munach. And the Aron was placed on this rock. The Ulifanav Tzenet Haman Umate Aharon, as we mentioned earlier, the man was there and the stick of Aron was there. Ube'esha Bana Shlomo Et Habayit. And it was there from already the time when Shlomo built the Mikdash. V'sofolehi charev. And they knew that it was going to be destroyed. But not makom lignoz bo et ha'aron l'mata b'matmoniot amukot ve'akalkalot. They, Shlomo HaMelech, when he built the Beit HaMikdash, he built a series of underground tunnels, knowing that the Beit HaMikdash was going to be destroyed. And this stone was the one that covered the opening to these tunnels. And now Yoshiyahu is taking the initiative and he is hiding the Aron in this place that Shlomo built. Shene'amar tenu et Aron HaKodesh v'ganzu im ha'aron mateh ha'aron v'tzenet ha'man v'shemen ha'mishcha. Not only is the Aron hidden there, but the man is hidden there, the mateh of Aron is hidden there, and the shemen ha'mishcha. Now, why is this important? How does this fit in with our theme? Hiding the Aron is a way for the nation to have a sense of revival when they build the next Mishkan. They are able to have a Shemen HaMishcha, they're able to appoint again the next king. This, Yoshiyahu says, I cannot stop the destruction, but what can I do? I can prepare, that's right, I can prepare for the future. And that is the whole idea of Hulda, and that is Hulda. Now, let's go back to her name for a minute. What, again. I think so. It doesn't use its name here, but I think that it references that as well. Now let's go back to her name. What does the name Hulda mean? It is a rodent, correct? I don't know if it's a rat. In modern day Hebrew, Hulda is really a weasel. A weasel. Rather than a rat. Now think about it for a minute. What? What does a weasel do? Where does a weasel live? He lives in underground tunnels. He is a burrowing animal. So the idea of associating Hulda, instead of looking at Hulda as being a negative and saying that it's, you know, a rodent, but it is a rodent who builds these tunnels where the Aron is able to have a place to live while they are in Galut. However, if you look at source number 4, you will see that source number 4 does not view Hulda as a positive name, but rather Hulda is a rodent. The Gemara says she was called rodent because she said, say to the man, instead of saying, say to the king. That was a lack of respect on her part, and therefore she gets like the name is sort of a punishment for how she talked to him. You could also say, by the way, that Huldah does not necessarily have to be from the weasel, but it comes from the word to rust. How do you say rust in Hebrew? Chaluda. That, and what does it mean? What, why would she be called Chaluda? That represents the nation. That the nation in her generation, think about Rusty for a minute. Rusty is really only the
surface
layer. And that if you scrub the rust off, you still have something good underneath. And that's the idea of Am Yisrael, that although in her generation they're rusty, the hope, the revival, that theme is still there, that she is able to...
Is there a source for it? The Chaluda?
I don't remember where. I can see if I can find it for you. Something that I saw. Right. You'll notice also, I noticed that also. When you look at, and Shafan, you'll notice the names at that point in time, Caleb, right, were very much, but also, especially during her generation, we have an Akbar, and we have a Shafan, and we have, that apparently those might have been the names at that point in time. But so we don't really know, and so that Huldah becomes a nevi'ah. That was the question we started with. He said, "In what way is Huldah the nevi'ah? Why is her message a message that we need for the future?" Because she tells and she gives this message to Yoshiyahu that even though destruction is coming, there are things you can do for that. So the first thing he does is he hides the Aron. But let's go back to that Pesach. What would be his goal of celebrating this massive Pesach? And it's described as one of the big Pesach ceremonies that was done in Klal Yisrael. It's called Pesach Yoshiyahu. What's he thinking?
He's... God would
I don't think he really thought that God was going to change at that point in time. But he wants them to go to exile with memories. He wants them to have real, tangible memories. Okay? And celebrating Pesach in Yerushalayim is a memory that they can really have and share. You know, last year we were in Yerushalayim. Last year we were at the Pesach when the whole nation was there. And you can really share at the Seder those kinds of experiences. And that's part of the tikvah. And that's part of the revival. Also, by the way, other things that Yoshiyahu does that we don't have here, but if you continue reading, he doesn't just throw up his arms and say, there is nothing I can do. He destroys Yeravam and Mizbeach. He still tries to get rid of the Avodah Zarah. He reads the Torah before all of the people. Okay, Yoshiyahu does a whole bunch of series of acts in order to give people these tangible experiences that they can take with him. Now, this is where the story of Huldah ends. But I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that the story of Yoshiyahu's scroll has some modern stories that changed actually the landscape of Bible studies. In 1805, there was a guy named W.E.T.T.E. was his name, and he wrote a book he called The Book of the Law, which was discovered by Chilkiyahu. He called the Book of the Law that was discovered, L-A-W, that was discovered by Chilkiyahu as Sefer Devarim. And then this theory was adopted by German scholars later on, and it became the prime explanation. You've all heard this, that Sefer Devarim was not actually written with the other scrolls, but Sefer Devarim was written much later. So they take this story of finding the scroll as not only finding the scroll, but as the writing of the scroll, so that the first four books of the Torah were written much earlier, and Devarim is considered a much later book that was written by argument. So the argument suggests that Sefer Devarim was written in the late 7th century, and you see that here from the Psukim. Now, There are other things besides just the finding of the Mikra that make these biblical scholars think that Devarim was much later. Whereas Shmot allows you to bring karbanot, every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you. You can bring karbanot in lots of places. Devarim comes along and says you can only bring karbanot in the place that Hashem will choose. So that is why all of a sudden, according to these biblical scholars, Yoshiyahu is revamping the Beit HaMikdash, and he's inviting the people to come to Yerushalayim to sacrifice. Secondly, one of the other things that Yoshiyahu does is he destroys these bamot. Until now, there are bamot. So why didn't anybody destroy it earlier? So according to these biblical scholars, because the commandment didn't exist earlier. It's only now when the Sefer Devarim is being written. He also destroys Avodah Zarah, that also is very much in Sefer Devarim. Sefer Devarim says a whole bunch of times, get rid of the Asherah, get rid of the Baal, get rid of all those things. So you see him doing that as well. The whole idea of the Korban Pesach in Yerushalayim suggests, perhaps, according to these biblical critics, that until then, where did they do Pesach? In all their various bamot. Mm-hmm. But Yoshiyahu was trying to teach them something new, that everybody should come to Yerushalayim. So based on all these observations, also there are certain linguistic differences between Sefer Devarim and some of the other books. So therefore they discovered that the discovered scroll was in fact a new book. Now remember, we did see something similar, that the Torah was open to Devarim. Remember, so it's not completely, so they're out of the blue where they are taking this from. And by the way, if we are saying that it's 7th century, who wrote it? Who was the one who wrote it? So the biblical critics think that it was composed by the priests who lived at that period in order to encourage Yoshiyahu to take on these reforms. And that would explain why he's so surprised when he finds it, and that's why he seems not to know about it, and that's why. Now, you should just know that this idea, by the way, is the idea that is most broadly accepted in the academic circles. Okay, needless to say that anybody who holds on to the idea of Torah Mish Sinai and HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave all of Torah to Moshe in the Midbar, we understand that that is not an acceptable answer. So how do we go about answering these different ideas? We have a whole bunch of different ways of proving them wrong. I'll go through some of them rather quickly. The thrust of Yoshiyahu's religious actions was getting rid of the Avodah Zarah. Now, this is not something that is just written in Devarim. We have it in many other places, the Isser of Avodah Zarah, and we have, pardon? Yeah, you have it all over, so you can't use that as a proof. The word bamot appears throughout Sefer Melachim as a constant unsolved problem. And so, Sefer Devarim, though, never once uses the term bama. If you tell me that was the whole thing, the bama, then why doesn't Sefer Devarim say, get rid of the bama? The word bama does not appear anyway in Sefer Devarim. So if you're saying that was its purpose of being written, then we respect that word to appear. If indeed Devarim was as late as they're saying, what word also should appear? If we're saying that the whole thing is central in Yerushalayim, then we would expect the word Yerushalayim to appear. And as you know, Yerushalayim does not appear. And if it's writing in the 7th century, where the Beit HaMikdash is standing in Yerushalayim, it would be ridiculous not to have the term Yerushalayim. Okay, Devarim, by the way, okay, as well as other books, doesn't talk about only one place to bring karbanot. Devarim also, remember, in Sefer Devarim, Bnei Yisrael commanded to build a mizbeach on Har Evel. right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of Sefer Devarim, with the brachot and the klodos har evel. If you tell me that's written in the 7th century, why are they building a mizbeach on har evel? And finally, this whole concept of Pesach. Okay, we know that Shmuel clearly says 3 times a year, go to Yerushalayim and make the Shlosh Regalim. Okay, and it's clear that people did leave their houses and do this. We also have already earlier in the time of Chizkiyahu, which is 80 years before Yoshiyahu, he too celebrates a Pesach in Yerushalayim, so this is not a new phenomenon. So in conclusion, although there have been hundreds of books that have been written on the topic, it is not clear, you know, the way that they want to make it sound, that Sefer Devarim was written in the 7th century, and we can see that there is certainly enough questions to raise on that theory to say that our theory is also a legitimate and, you know, perhaps even a more successful explanation for Sefer Devarim.